You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Monday, October 8th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. It is Columbus Day, and consistent with my Italian heritage, well, not fully Italian, let's say Mediterranean heritage, well, not so much Mediterranean, actually, probably Eastern European, but, well, I'm Jewish, and Mila has the day off from school, and so, alas, we don't have a babysitter, and so I have pre-recorded this program today for you, ladies and gentlemen, but I know that you will enjoy it. Because on the program today, we will be talking with Mr. Kevin Baker, writer, Harper's Magazine, author of multiple books, including a trilogy, historical fiction of New York City. And we will be discussing his piece on the cover, Harper's Magazine, Why Vote When Your Vote Counts for Nothing. We will be back live tomorrow, Tuesday. Same channel, same time. Unless, of course, you decide to listen to it at a different time, which you can do via podcast. If you want to support this program, by all means, do so. And you can do so by becoming a member of the Majority Report at majority.fm. Sign up to become a member. It is your support that makes this program possible. Do not let the corporate media be the only media. And now, ladies and gentlemen, my interview with Kevin Baker. All right, ladies and gentlemen, on the phone, it is a pleasure to welcome back to this program the author, Kevin Baker, of course, most well known by his, I think, his trilogy of New York City, what would you call it, historical fiction, right? Yeah. Stryver's Row, Dreamland, and Paradise Alley. And, of course, you can purchase those at kevinbaker.com, is it? Info? We'll put a link. We'll put a link. And, of course, now also writing for Harper's Magazine. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me, Sam.
So your cover piece in Harper's, and I would have Harper's know that to access your cover piece, I actually subscribed. So Harper's should be on notice, ladies and gentlemen. If you want to drive traffic, it's Kevin Baker on the cover, as far as I'm concerned.
And we're on the blog. Myself and Jack Hitt are blogging all the time about the election at harpers.org. So
yes, and
check it out.
We spoke to both you guys. Obviously, we're at the conventions. Worth checking out. And so your cover piece, Why Vote? You start with you're basically critiquing, I guess, democracy now, or at least the execution of democracy, or rather the way that democracy has been executed in both senses of the word in some respects.
Right.
Tell us what it used to be.
Well, you know, democracy at its core is very transactional, and it always has been here in the United States, as well as, you know, most other places. It's basically, you know, the candidate comes out and says he'll do X, Y, and Z, and you vote for him on that basis. And you want there to be kind of a, at least an attempt at a quid pro quo. You want the candidate to at least try to do what they said they would do for you. And unfortunately, that process seems to have broken down now, particularly with the Democratic Party and with in the United States, and pretty much with almost all liberal leftist parties around the Western world, whereby now the leadership of these parties simply refuses to do what the people who vote for them want them to do. They're, are just kind of not willing to, to try to do the stuff they ran on. You know, they run constantly on these sort of populist, progressive, liberal stands, and then those are simply abandoned the minute they get into office.
All right. Well, before we get into the reasons that may impact that, or why you think they might, but let's go back to our early democracy in this country, which you describe as being crudely transactional. And nobody knows, I think, this era, at least in terms of New York politics, in the way you do. Well, I'm sure there's some people, but not my book. Tell us about how that worked.
Well, you know, and it wasn't only even New York. It was like all over the place. You know, you would right back to the first days of the Republic. You know, ballots weren't secret, and you would go out there and you would get a a glass of hard cider maybe for your vote. I'm sorry to say ballots weren't public. Ballots weren't private, and you would go out and get a glass of hard cider for your vote. You would get straight up money. And this is very much the case in the urban machines, particularly, who really made it into a science. So in New York or Chicago or wherever, you would get things like a public job, from these machines, who would invent jobs. You know, like Al Smith started off life as a guy who would go and check up on whether people's excuses for getting out of juries were actually valid. You know, he'd go and see if you were actually at work, or whatever. This was pretty much a straightforward thing. If you worked for the machine and you voted for the machine, you would get something, money, a job, some kind of favor. And that's how it ran for a long time. And it was a very limited system because the machine had no vested interest in doing things for you long term, in giving you kind of any greater opportunities. You know, it wasn't interested in getting you to college or getting you a really good job, because in that case you wouldn't be dependent on the machine anymore.
And so what happened to that? I mean, what was the next phase after that, I guess, after the machine politics?
That inevitably broke down because the machine was also, although it did a lot of things, it was the only machine was machines in the cities were the only people basically doing anything for new immigrants. But essentially, they weren't doing enough. They were conservative at their core, in the sense that they would also do whatever big business wanted them to do, and in return for various other sorts of bribes, such as businesses providing campaign support. So essentially, you had these machines that were supposed to be representing working people, but they weren't doing things like, you know, so they would actually, you know, help deploy the police against strikers and break unions in support of business. You know, this is the sort of thing that would go on. So eventually, that, you know, working people got fed up with that, and more started to rebel against the machines. And then when the machines really couldn't provide enough aid during Depression, you know, it all fell apart. And Roosevelt came in and, with the New Deal, pushed across a whole other kind of idea of citizenship in the United States, whereby you actually got things as a right, not simply a favor from the machine. And those things included stuff that really made you very independent as a citizen for the first time. You know, you could get a college education thanks to the help of government loans and scholarships. You could get, decent jobs. You know, the unions were supported by the administration, and, you know, your wages went up, and you didn't have to depend on the machines for things like shoes for your kid or for a turkey dinner at Christmas, the classic sort of, you know, for the social welfare the machines provided. So this was a huge change and a huge advantage to, to people in the United States in general. And it kind of freed people from that sort of serfdom in politics.
And so what is the difference there? I mean, we go from sort of this crudely transactional, you call it,
right.
Where there is no the idea is simply we're going to hand out favors to whomever it is in our interest at any given moment to hand out favors to, but not so much that we would empower them so that we can still maintain this dynamic. The reforms that FDR puts in place, in fact, empower the citizen. So is that transactionally? I mean, is that still a transaction? I mean, because in some ways it's like we're actually going to give you political power so that you can actually get some of these things through the political process.
Right. Well, and it actually, it's a transaction, but it allows you it to be a much more sort of broadly enlightened one. You know, you can think in your enlightened self-interest down the road, so you don't have to be worrying about your day-to-day existence necessarily. You can also worry about things like what, you know, climate change is going to do to, you know, to your children's future. You can worry about,
Civil rights.
Civil rights, exactly. You don't have to put up with the corruption of the local ward healer because you don't depend on him. You don't have to put up with him wasting your tax money. You can kick him out because you're not dependent on him for your day-to-day existence.
And so the evolution of that, we go from that that period where, and it's interesting. I just want to stay on the sort of the on the municipal level, because one of the things that I did, you know, from a historical standpoint, I've done some reading about is sort of what changed urban wise. And one of the things I know that displaced sort of the machine politics was this notion of like good government reform, where you would have where you would replace a strong mayor, let's say, or a machine with a city council that was generally elected at large, as opposed to from a district standpoint. And then they would appoint a city manager to sort of professionalize these things. And my experience, at least in terms of studying it when it took place in my hometown, Worcester, Massachusetts, is that it really benefited the industrialists, the very wealthy people who wanted to sort of stand back a little bit and pull the strings. It actually, in some weird way, made government, I guess, less responsive to corruption, but also less responsive to people.
Yeah, that was the trouble. Was like the progressives tried all these, systemic changes in government to see if that would work, and a lot of those were worthwhile experiences. A lot of those were worthwhile experiments, but a lot of them became ultimately really corrupted too. A great example is California, where progressives like Hiram Johnson, back in the 1910s, pushed through all these things like the recall and referenda, and this is all to get around the corrupt, you know, machines and give, like, real power directly to the people. But yet, as we see now, you know, 100 years later, this has just slowed government to a crawl and really serves the agenda now of wealthy individuals and corporations who put any kind of referendum they want on the ballot, and, you know, and the Republicans recalling Gray Davis as governor. It really can, almost any process can be corrupted if there's not an energized, active citizenry looking into it. You know, what the more general liberal idea was to have people still in charge of the process, it really depended on elected government. But those people were given more opportunity and more education and more ability in general to make what we hope are enlightened choices, and, you know, that didn't just depend on simple need. And I think that is really, you know, what's worked best out of all these attempts at reform. You know, another example is in New York, they came up with all these public authorities under Robert Moses to get around the political machines. And this worked really, really well at first. You know, and what it did was you had, you know, you were able to build things like Jones Beach, thanks to the public authorities. But ultimately, they became hugely corrupted, or not. Ultimately, they got completely out of control. And, you know, one of these separate public authorities issuing its own junk bonds was the actual cause of the bankruptcy crisis in New York in 1975. You know, New York wasn't particularly worse run than it ever is at the time. What it was this thing, the Urban Development Corporation, which is still around under a different name, was issuing these junk bonds that went bad and almost brought down the biggest, the greatest city in the Western world. So there's no system per se that will work, well enough on its own. You need this kind of transactional element at the heart of it all between people and their leaders. You need leaders to respond to people.
It's interesting. And so we move from that era of, the FDR reforms. And at what point do we start getting away, at least in the context of American politics, from this sort of responsiveness?
Well, I think it was really with the rise of the so-called centrist Democrats. And I was just debating this a little bit with Mark Leah, the brilliant New York Review of Books writer who was a professor at Columbia who was making a strong case for democratic centrism recently. But, you know, to me, this is where the elite in at least the Democratic Party starts to kind of break away from the individuals who are actually electing people. When you have people like, to a certain degree, Jimmy Carter, but much more all these sort of DLC Democrats,
mm-hmm.
Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, who run on one thing. You know, people forget Bill Clinton ran a very populist campaign in 1992. It was people over profits, and we were promised all these sort of liberal, outright liberal changes. Same thing with Barack Obama, much as...
And we should say, he did this while he was still, or had just, he was the first chair or president of the DLC,
yeah.
Which, for people who don't know, was an organization set up with the explicit purpose of seeking and soliciting corporate money into the Democratic Party, because... By that point, the strength of unions was beginning to decline, and people were making, either they were making the argument that we electorally we need to access to this corporate money, or they also, it was a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right, and people were acting still at pretending that, George McGovern was some kind of crazy radical, and the party had gone, too far to the left then, very dubious things. But that was their argument. That's why Democrats couldn't win national elections. And, all right, then that's an argument to make, and if they had been open and honest about that, that would be something to, and if they won on that basis, if they won the party over on that basis, then fine, we could say that, okay, you guys, this is what the people want, and we'll proceed on this basis. But that wasn't what we, what we got at all. What we got instead was this pretense at these people still being liberals and still being populist and getting people to vote for them on that basis. Because in general, there really wasn't much support for this big center DLC position. That's just, they've just never really been able to build kind of any kind of working, majority, on their own with this. So essentially they use this cover. But what this does is really degrade politics. Because every election then becomes this exercise in deception. It becomes what lies the candidates, and Republican as well as Democrat, incidentally, but it becomes what lies the candidates can tell you that will persuade you to vote for them so they can just do whatever they want as unattached and un, and no longer responsible elites while they're actually in office.
How is this different from the fact that we at least feel, and probably I would think correctly, that politicians have always lied?
Well, politicians have always lied, and, you know, for various reasons, and politicians are never able to do everything they say. But there's a difference between, say, maybe whitewashing the truth a little, and there's a difference between not being able to get everything you hope to deliver and simply setting off immediately on another course. I mean, you know, George W. Bush ran practically as an isolationist in 2000. And here he is, all of, you know, the constant criticisms in the campaign of Democratic attempts at what they called nation building in places like Haiti. Well, you know, within 2 years, he's off trying the biggest, craziest nation building project in our history in Iraq. And he would argue that's due to 9/11, but of course it wasn't. It was due to Republicans' particular obsession with Iraq and due to the fact that he turned over the foreign policy of the country to all of these crazy neocons.
Right, and I would also argue, and forgive me, Kevin, just got to watch out because we got little wind noises on your phone.
But I would
argue that the notion that 25 men would fundamentally alter the reality of what your foreign policy should be in that way is ridiculous in and of itself. And we also know on day one they were looking to attack Iraq. So,
Right. So, you know, this was always a disingenuous thing, in other words. And you have the same thing in the case with the Democrats and under Barack Obama coming in here. And he comes in and immediately appoints all of the same Clinton advisors who had done a lot to create the fiscal, the financial crisis in the first place, and who he had run against in running against Hillary in the primaries. So that was almost as if FDR had come in and appointed Andrew Mellon Secretary of the Treasury again, the same Secretary of the Treasury who had served under three Republican presidents in the 20s. He had come in 1933 and said, well, you know, the economy really was better when Mellon was running it, and that little meltdown thing, you know, we're over that now, so I'm bringing them back. You know, I mean, people would have been horrified, but this is what Obama did, and this is what a lot of his troubles since then have come from.
Now, and so when we talk about the politicians lying, what we're talking about is less about the specifics, or less about a failure to deliver on certain sort of, I mean, transactional things, but more in terms of just sort of a general overarching approach. It's almost as if they're wearing different clothing in some way.
Right. It's an approach that's disingenuous to start with. It's this is sort of the thing. It's an approach that was never intended to be serious at all. You know, this is what's the difference between that and not delivering everything, or maybe exaggerating a little what you're doing. You know, quite obviously, Barack Obama never intended to do a lot of what he had promised. You know, there was no serious attempt at bringing in single payer, no serious attempt at even a public option in healthcare, no serious attempt at, say, getting card check for unions. None of this was stuff that he obviously had intended to do at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think to the extent that he put on any type of populist airs, and there's some, you know, debate as to whether or not he did. I mean, he's clearly doing it now. He's clearly done it since September. But we should say that people should be either heartened or not by the fact that this is not unique to American politics, that you're outlining this in your piece, that this notion has spread. Well, you say that it exists in Europe as well. We're seeing this. Outline that for us, and let me know if you think it's spread from here. Because, you know, one of the things that I think people are not aware of is that many political consultants in this country, in their off years, are working in Europe or working just all the way around the country. I mean, over the world.
In Europe, you've had a huge betrayal of the traditional political system there, with all of these kind of quasi-socialist, you know, very much more liberal than we are, parties, and the entire you know, parties, the entire political spectrum is Europe has been more tilted to the left. And this has all been betrayed. In part, it's been betrayed by the very nature of the European Union, which a lot of people didn't understand. It's just going to hand power over to these unelected bankers and bureaucrats who are proving to be every bit as crazily conservative as the bankers and you know who run things like the Republican Party here. You know, in part, this was also yes, very much due to kind of this Americanization of their politics, whereby it's all sort of shifted to the right, and it's very much more this thing aimed at, you know, I mean, aimed at bailing out, you know, German bankers, you know, telling people like the entire citizenry of Greece that neither they nor their children really have a future. They're going to have to be generations of sacrifice, and that's you know, that's just too damn bad. You know, and people aren't standing for this, which is why the continent's descending more and more into chaos just now.
What do you think? Is this something that simply happens in the life cycle of civilizations? And you know, there's been eras where, because it, you know, what we're talking about is because there's still, I guess, it's not democracy, but there's still sort of like functioning transactional relationship between the plutocrats and our government. And it seems to be something that we're seeing, you know, internationally. I mean, in fact, I think you could probably make the argument that President Obama, in terms of to the extent that he has betrayed any type of populist notion, to the extent that he's not responding to the, I guess, the idea of empowerment by of its citizenry. I mean, because that's really, when we talk about the public option, I mean, I don't want to digress here, but when we talk about the public option, the real issue here, it seems to me, is not sort of the transactional idea of for some small percentage of the population, there'll be a public option here. The reason why I think the public option was so important to many of us on the left was that it was a foot in the door of disempowering the insurance corporations in some way, which hopefully would lead to their further disempowerment down the road, which would ultimately lead to more empowerment of the people. And that's what we were looking for from him. To the extent that he has betrayed that idea, you know, putting aside the small, narrow policy implications of a public option, he has done so almost less so than what we've seen in Europe.
Yes, to a certain degree of like there's kind of been more disempowerment in Europe. It's true. Although he also did things like, you know, by not supporting any kind of attempts to revive unions, he's refusing to re-empower working people that way. You know, and this is sort of the thing too, the very dangerous thing, which is that there's much more of a reward for politicians from these sort of plutocrats, from this whole establishment of bankers and whoever else. I mean, one of the things we always had an advantage of in terms of the before of one of the things we always had an advantage of before was that politicians at least needed to be reelected before. You know, so they would have to pay attention to people to a certain degree. Now, even winning re-election, not necessarily that big a deal, just because you get this much bigger reward awaiting you in the private sector if you're a good boy and you do what you're told. You know, you get like millions and millions of dollars here. So,
even if that's not an incentive per se, it is not the disincentive that it used to be.
Yeah, exactly. It's not the disincentive that it used to be. You know, so now you don't even have to worry so much about being about losing your seat, because that's not your sole income. It's not going to be even a fraction of what you stand to make doing other things.
So, that's what we call around here a champagne problem.
Yes. Yeah. So this is sort of this is sort of what's going on, and this again kind of disrupts that other transaction between voters and between and the people represent them.
Well, so, I mean, so should we vote? I mean, you know, I don't want to give away, I don't want to give away the ending of the story, but, you know, should we vote? I mean, if we are aware of the fact that we are, our vote is not being responded to, that we are voting based upon cues that we cannot really trust in terms of like at their very core, should we vote?
Well, and ultimately what I come down with is saying that, yes, of course we should vote. You should always vote. You should always, you know, I mean, voting ultimately is a choice. You know, it's not an act of political theater. It's not, you know, some way for one to act out and do something. It's just, it is a choice, and you have to make that choice ultimately, even when you don't like it. And in this case, yes, you know, because there is no, say, other kind of, you know, new party that we might prefer around, because we have not built that any kind of other liberal or progressive party that we would, you know, prefer to be part of. We have to therefore vote to give ourselves the chance to do that. I mean, think of what a kind of Romney presidency would be, and kind of a full Republican power over the you know, over this would be. It's you know, over this country and over this world would be, is just, you know, I mean, it would be an act of national suicide to put this in. You know, you think about what will happen between the eight or nine different wars that John McCain advocated at the in the at the convention. You think about all of the different you know, sort of environmental things that would go on. I mean, nothing would be done about you know, climate change ultimately at this crucial time. We really would have an invasion of Iran, very possibly. You would have all this sort of things, all these sort of things like fracking going on. Just horrible.
Much of what we have now, but I guess you're just talking about it would be increased?
Yeah. Everything now that's problematic would be worsened, you know, and we would have to be scrambling to cut just to recover from this, you know, much as the same way as, you know, electing Ronald Reagan led to this, you know, it helped lead to this immediate boom, but this long-term damage that Democrats have been trying to recover and the country has been trying to recover from ever since, you know, and this is what what we're looking at with the Romney victory. Of course, the trouble is now the center doesn't even seem able to, you know, to hold us hostage any longer, judging by Barack Obama's performance at the debate.
Right. Well, you know, it's funny because I was reading a Doug Henwood piece on that debate, and he really did say that the real value that you know, Obama's problem in the debate was more structural, but he said that the real value of
structural in the sense of the structure falling down and collapsing on everyone.
More structural in terms of where his sympathies lie. But that ultimately an Obama presidency at least brings into stark relief what the structural problems are what we have with our government. And in some respects, you're making a similar case, is that we need a baseline from which to operate, and at least this one is one where we're a little bit less on the defensive and can begin to make some real changes, and also one that I think provides a little bit more clarity. We all know what we think in terms of the Republicans' agenda. There is some value in being reminded that, at the very least, the president of the Democratic Party, the president who is of the Democratic Party, has some similar tendencies.
Yes. Yeah, similar tendencies to us, or to and simply to make a you know, kind of this party work, to make the administration work, he has to recruit people who are, you know, kind of stand for decent things.
Well, I'm talking about similarities in terms of what we see in terms of really being more responsive to the plutocrats.
I mean that's the thing. Yeah, all too many responsive, you know. And my gosh, the thing at the debate, like that stunning thing where Obama allowed that he might have some differences with Mitt Romney on Social Security, my goodness. Right. That was terrifying to see that, where you couldn't even define what their differences are. And it's terrifying how those differences keep closing. I mean, yeah, in the long term, you know, to allow the DLC and its spawn to continue to run the Democratic Party is just going to be disastrous. So.
All right. Well, Kevin, thanks so much for spending the time. It's a really fascinating, obviously, as usual, brilliantly written piece. And I appreciate you coming on and talking to us about it.
Well, thanks so much, Sam. That's terrific to hear. And, you know, great talking to you.